This is the Paula Gordon Show, Conversations with People at the Leading Edge. What a pleasure to be in the company both of René Descartes and Russell Shorto, who talks about Descartes and the time in which he lived with a very clever twist, Descartes' Bones, a skeletal history of the conflict between faith and reason. We went away talking about certainty. That really is a major theme through your book, isn't mm-hmm. it? The search mm-hmm. for, the longing for, the inability ever to find.
which, as Bill said, played out in the pre-modern world in one way, and in the modern world in quite another way. But in both cases, you have humans hungering for certainty and having a different, looking for it with it from a different foundation. And what is interesting to me in the small story of Descartes' Bones is that there are a number of times when a particular relic of Descartes, his skull, comes into the picture, resurfaces. And for example, in the 1820s, the French Academy of Sciences, it's brought to their attention that the remains of Descartes have been sitting ever since the French Revolution in a garden somewhere, and they decide they have to do something about this. They open it up and they discover there's no skull.
Oops.
It just so happens that a Swedish chemist has been visiting them. He returns to Sweden. A couple of years later, he's opening a newspaper in Stockholm, and he sees that somebody has died and his estate is being auctioned, and among the items is the skull of René Descartes. So he rushes to it turns out a casino operator has bought the skull in order to decorate his casino with it, I guess. And he buys it from him and sends it to the savants at the French Academy. And there's this great, you know, image in around 1820 when you have all these leading French scientists gathered around this skull, you know, observing it with, you know, appropriate secular reverence, I guess. And then comes the question, how do we know for sure this is Descartes' skull? And so it starts again, this quest for certainty over the object.
This is a very modern, and I think it must be part of why you spent the time writing this book, a modern concern, this notion of certainty, mm-hmm. and all the various ways that we keep trying to reach it, and usually lying to ourselves in the process. I finished your book yesterday morning. Last night I had this sense that it was something I wanted to do, so I sat down and watched The Fog of War. Mm-hmm. Are you familiar with The Fog of War?
I'm familiar with it. I haven't read it.
It's about McNamara.
Yeah.
And it's about McNamara's role in, particularly with respect to Vietnam. Mm-hmm. And McNamara, of course, in his best and brightest, as mm-hmm. Halberstam, and McNamara as well, that's what they called themselves, and it's what mm-hmm. Halberstam wrote about. These were very smart people. They were people who whose logic was impeccable.
Very reasonable people.
Very reasonable mm-hmm. people. And this, The Fog of War, essentially, the subtitle is, you know, 11 rules that McNamara learned about how to run the world.
Too late.
There were three of them that jumped out at me as I sat and watched this and thought about you. Rule number two was rationality will not save us.
Mm-hmm.
Rule number seven is belief and seeing are both often wrong. And again, this plugs in directly mm-hmm. to what you're talking about. And number eight is be prepared to re-examine your reasoning.
Mm-hmm.
And I say all this because the consequences of what you're talking about, this is not just an academic exercise. This is not just an intellectual exercise. This is not just an exercise in reading a book. The kinds of things you're talking about have real-world consequences mm-hmm. all day, every day.
Yeah.
And we ignore them at our peril.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I completely agree, and that gets back to this notion of, you know, and when you say that, I particularly think of it in terms of the spate of books in recent years by Christopher Hitchens and Richard Dawkins who are basically saying, you know, apropos of this period in which you have warring religious fundamentalisms, these people are going to annihilate themselves. We have, over the past few centuries, learned a thing or two that is really, truly part of the as Hitchens says, the infancy of our species, and we have to recognize that and move on. When you say, you know, rationality isn't going to do it, right? That alone isn't the answer. I mean, it simply isn't because, for one thing, our ability to employ reason is flawed. And for another, reason is only part of the sphere. It's only part of the human spectrum, part of the spectrum of reality.
Well, and there has been, you know, yes, there, we've learned a great deal. One of the things we've learned in that intervening period, of course, is the limits of reason. You've got Gödel's incompleteness theorem that just undercuts this, the whole basic notion. The fundament of reason ultimately gets you to logic. Mm-hmm. And Whitehead and Bertrand Russell formalized, mathematized logic. So we can track it. The problem, of course, is it doesn't apply to the world we live in exclusively. Mm-hmm. I mean, you simply cannot reach truth via that mechanism with respect even to the internals of logic, which is what Gödel was about. Once you add people into that equation, humans into that equation, with all the things that we come equipped with.
Including those emotions of which you spoke. Well,
the emotion, that's why the heart piece to me is so important. We simply have to incorporate, include other things in our thinking. The heart, an example.
Yeah, unfortunately we're in agreement, because it would be a more fruitful discussion, I guess.
We can explore agreement.
But
when did you stumble on this heart thing? Because it seems to me that in a way, a back channel to what Bill is saying is when you came upon this little piece of information that you put in the epilogue, that you've told the whole story all over again.
It gives you a whole different wash on the story.
Tell us that story.
First of all, where it comes in Descartes' life is interesting. Descartes he was a vain, irascible, unpleasant loner who had many friends as long as they were devotees of his. And when they argued with him, then they were no longer friends.
He didn't say vindictive, which is also...
And vindictive as well, yeah. And he had one known intimate relationship in his life. When he was staying in Amsterdam with an Englishman, he had a relationship with... with the housekeeper, a woman named Helena Jantz. And he was enough of a nerd that he even wrote down the date that they did it. And 9 months later, a daughter was born. They named her Francine, and she was the love of his life. And for a while, he acknowledged her, but not officially.
Because of the social...
Presumably because of circumstances, he couldn't do that. So for a while, this little family traveled around, because he was constantly traveling. And Helena Jantz was officially his housekeeper, and Francine was officially his niece. And she died when she was 5 years old of scarlet fever. And this whole period, from the beginning of this relationship through his child's death, corresponds, first of all, with a broadening of his philosophy, sort of a deepening of his philosophy. But also, after this period is when he writes The Passions of the Soul and hits on this notion of the importance of the emotions, philosophically, in terms of human understanding of reality.
So it's long after he's written The Method.
Right. So this suggests that, you know, maybe he had his own, he had done his own experiments on himself and was using this input as a way to try to comprehend and realize that this is another overlay on mind-body dualism.
And then many years later, it is discovered quite recently by somebody doing sleuth work as an historian that he didn't just throw over the housekeeper.
Oh, okay. I'm sorry.
Love story.
The story continues.
Descartes
in love, yes. It was long assumed that he had this affair with this woman, and then after the daughter was what held them together, and then after she died, you don't hear about Helena Jantz anymore. A few years ago, a Dutch historian did some inspired archival digging. Descartes had lived for a time in the little village of Egmond by the sea in the Netherlands, and he did some digging nearby and discovered that a woman named Helena Jantz married a much younger man. She was in her 30s. He was, I think, 17 at the time. And lo and behold, you know, Helena Jantz was a fairly common name, but lo and behold, the man who put up the dowry for her was Descartes. So a Dutch philosopher named Theo Verbeek, who is now editing Descartes' correspondence, thinks that the possibility is that she was pregnant again. and that Descartes was marrying her because he just couldn't, it was going to happen again. He couldn't deal with this all over again. In any event, she marries, lives on. He then goes to Sweden to the ice and the cold and dies. And it's as though, you know, he has reached this point of understanding, incorporating Hart into his theories, but he's not going to participate in it himself. He goes off and dies. She, however, has a life. She has a husband. They have a child. They becomes an innkeeper. The inn goes on through the decades. So this kind of experience, a much more human experience of the interaction between heart, mind, and body, is present and continues in the aftermath of Descartes' life, but he doesn't experience the full of it.
One of the fascinating things about this is that you point out is how central biology or protobiology mm-hmm. was in his thinking. Mm-hmm. You tend to think of this period in Newtonian terms because yeah. Newton, for a lot of us, sort of defines what the Enlightenment was about. Mm-hmm. It's physics.
It's also English.
Mm-hmm. And recently, very recently, a friend of ours, Stuart Kaufman, has written a book about, he calls it Reinventing the Sacred, which is a whole other story, but it's not irrelevant to what we're talking about. He's arguing against reductionism, scientific mm-hmm. reductionism. He's a theoretical biologist, mm-hmm. and he is arguing that there are things we simply cannot know, predict, based on our science, and mm-hmm. that biology, and specifically evolution, is the principal evidence for that. Mm-hmm. And it seems to me that connects to the kinds of things you're talking about, because part of the assumption that we tend to have about the Enlightenment and about reason is that because we know, understand, we think, or at least thought briefly, understand or almost understand the laws of nature, mm-hmm. that we understand how the world works, mm-hmm. and that everything can be reduced to quarks and gluons mm-hmm. and mm-hmm. other mm-hmm. exotic particles, Higgs bosons, assuming they exist. And Dr. Kaufman's argument is, I think, in some ways parallel to what you're talking about, which is there are things that we simply cannot know based on science.
Mm-hmm. And when sure. we come back with Russell Shorto, he'll tell us all those things that we cannot know based on science that maybe we can know based on biology, and we'll explore when we come back. Be with us.